From NPR, it's Latino USA. We always hear the undocumented live in the shadows of our country, but do they really? Chances are, someone you know or are familiar with is undocumented.
Pop quiz! As a teenager, I was A, in high school, B, high, C, an undocumented immigrant, D, a regular cast member of Sesame Street, or E, all of the above. And the answer is E, all of the above.
They're American in every way, except for their papers. Today, stories of coming out undocumented and American.
I think when you come out about something to someone, what you're basically doing is forcing them to look you in the eye and somehow find themselves in you. Right? I mean, that's what we're forcing Americans to do.
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us, but first, las noticias. An Arizona public school chief ruled that the Tucson Unified School District is in violation of a state law for not ending its ethnic studies program. Arizona's HB 2281 was signed into law over a year ago. Michael Simpson is the National Education Association's legal expert. He joins us to give us some background on what went on there in Arizona and what's happening now. So give us a little bit of background, Michael. What happened? How did this all come to a head in Arizona?
The former Secretary of Education had gotten complaints from various people that the Tucson Ethnic Studies program was a little too adversarial. And he got the Arizona legislature to pass a law that was aimed specifically at the Tucson Ethnic Studies program. As a result of the passage of that law, the state hired an outside auditing firm to come in and look at the Ethnic Studies program to see if it violated any of these prohibitions set forth in the law. They sat in on some classes, they interviewed students and teachers, and their conclusion was that the content of the curriculum did not violate the four prohibitions set forth in HB 2281. That conclusion was given to the Secretary of Education, who said, I disagree with it. I'm going to conduct my own review. Well, in this particular case, the state law said you can't have an ethnic studies program that teaches victimization, that promotes the overthrow of the U.S. government, that promotes resentment toward one race or one class, and that advocates ethnic solidarity instead of the treatment of pupils as individuals. And the State Department of Education made the determination the TUSD program violated three of those prohibitions, and thus the state could and should cut off part of their funding to USD.
What does it mean on a national scale?
That other states that have ethnic studies programs may look at the Arizona law as they did the anti-immigration law. It was copied in Alabama and Georgia and other places. So I think there is potential for other states to follow suit. We think both the decision of the Arizona legislature and the decision of the Tucson Unified School District to suspend the ethnic studies program is woefully short-sighted and woefully misguided.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
Now, Agustin Romero joins us. He's the founder and director of the Ethnic Studies Program in the Tucson Public Schools. Welcome to Latino USA, Agustin.
Thank you for having me.
Agustin, give us a little background here first. When did this program begin, and what did you hope to accomplish?
What we're talking about here is the Mexican American Studies Program. The department was created in 1998. And in 2002, I was asked to come aboard as director of the department and per No Child Left Behind to create a program that specifically alleviated the achievement gap for Mexican-American students. We can say without question, given the 7 years of data that we've collected and the different levels of scrutiny that data has gone through, that our students in our classes outperform all other students on all three aspects of the AIMS test, which is our high-stakes graduation exam. We know that students in our courses, when compared to similar cohorts, graduate from high school at a greater rate. And at the same time, those same students attend college, matriculate to college at a significantly higher rate than their non-Mexican American studies peers.
Why is the program attracting so much criticism if, in fact, you can show that it's been successful?
The attack on the program is specifically and clearly a racist political agenda. We're in a situation where a law has been created and that the creators of the law to this date have not been able to define for us what that law means.
When you hear people say, but you know what, to teach these programs in segmented ways, it's divisive. You've heard that before. What do you say to that?
One of the provisions of the law says that these classes have been specifically designed for a particular group of kids. In our original intent, the courses were designed to help alleviate the achievement gap for Latino Mexican American students, never to the exclusion of any other child. Any other child of any ethnicity has the opportunity to understand and gain a different perspective, a much richer perspective on another view of American history through another lens. All we've done is enrich the fabric by which these students understand this great country to be. Given that understanding, this is a program that should be replicated, not eradicated.
All right, Agustin Romero, thank you so much for speaking with us, and good luck in Arizona.
Thank you.
Agustin Romero is a founder and was the director of the Ethnic Studies Program in the Tucson Public Schools. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter. We are LatinoUSA, all one word, and we're back in 30 seconds. That's 30 segundos, so stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, stories of coming out, voices from across the country and from different walks of life. They're American in every way, except for one exception, their papers. Sometimes those who are coming out are actually high profile. There are others who are promising students with dreams of becoming doctors and lawyers. Even former Washington Post reporter Jose Antonio Vargas. While he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, he's probably best known for his June article in last year's New York Times Magazine, where he declared to the world, "I am undocumented and I am not alone."
All my life, as a writer, I've always wanted to write for The New Yorker. Ever since I picked it up and couldn't understand any of the words, I was like, I want to go write for this thing. And here I was writing for it, working on an exclusive profile of Mark Zuckerberg. And he was asking me this question of where I was from, and I couldn't answer him. I mean, the simple answer was, I'm from Mountain View, which is the town next to him. But I knew that wasn't the simple answer to that question. And then around that time, I was reading a lot, mostly following dream activists on Twitter. You know, I mean, this is the beauty of social media, right? I was kind of following them without really following them. And that's when I think it was planted in my head that it was too surreal, you know? Like, I thought to myself, if I became successful enough, if I win some sort of a big prize, or if I started writing for this thing called The New Yorker, if I lived in Manhattan, like Woody Allen shot Manhattan, if I, you know, have covered a campaign or interviewed all these important people, I mean, how could they say that I was, quote unquote, this illegal person? How could they say that I am not contributing? And yet, my predicament, my system of reality was so skewed. And that was when I made up my mind. That was my next story, was the magazine essay writing about my life as an undocumented immigrant.
When you realized that you were going to go public, was it fear? Was it excitement? Because, you know, finally,
yeah,
you were going to shed this baggage.
It's so interesting because people have been asking me a lot about what was harder, you know, coming out as gay or coming out as this. Which is so interesting to me, just the term coming out. Because, you know, what is out to you is in to me. This is my life. This is what I live with daily. And I guess that's where I find the humanity in this. You know, I think when you come out about something to someone, what you're basically doing is forcing them to look you in the eye and somewhat, somehow, find themselves in you. So the question that I had to ask myself was, if I do this, I was really worried about my grandmother, my abuela, my grandmother. She raised me, you know. There's not a moment that I walk out of that door that she wasn't worried that something was going to happen to me. And she was my first kind of like, okay, can she handle this? That was the first question. Second question, if I come out, what purpose would it serve? I didn't want it to be this Jose Vargas vanity act. I was so afraid. You know, I'm a journalist. I know how this thing works. You know, I come out, they put me in some sort of a crazy, oh my God, can't believe that this journalist that's been to the White House. And I was so afraid that journalists were going to lose sight of the bigger picture. And then the question becomes then, once I come out, how do I fit in the larger immigrant rights struggle? What lane must I stay on? You know, I'm not an organizer. That's not what I do. I'm not a leader. I'm a writer. I'm a journalist. That's what I do. So once I've answered all those questions, I was like, okay, I'm ready to go.
When you were following the Dream activists on Twitter as they were as they were making their march, their walk, they couldn't be any more different than you either, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're Filipino, they were Latino, et cetera, et cetera. But
I had a job.
You had a job.
I was privileged in some ways, right?
You had finished college, they hadn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you actually see yourself in them?
I think there were two feelings. One is, yes, I saw myself in them thinking, you know, I was in their shoes just 5 years. I graduated college 2004. I got out of college and I just ran. You know, I lived in D.C. in 5 years and I couldn't even tell you what living in D.C. was. For me, every day was like the story that I was working on. It wasn't even – I was so myopic. And in some ways, they were facing what I was too afraid to face, right? And remember, what I had done was check the boxes, the one that I wasn't supposed to be checking, right? But more importantly, I think I felt a real sense of guilt. The guilt came with the fact that, look, my name is Jose Antonio Vargas, but I don't look like Jose Antonio Vargas. What would have happened if I actually had darker skin and I spoke with a Spanish accent? Would I have been able to pass the way that I did? I'm not sure. I actually talked, I was in Dallas for a convention of United with Dream, and I had this guy, Carlos, come up to me, and he said, I don't speak English as good as you. Because he was saying that, you know, he wanted to be successful and all that stuff, and I was looking at him, and I was, you know, it's okay. Like, it doesn't make you any... There's a thing in the Dream Act community about being the model minority, right? Like being the model undocumented student who's the valedictorian, or who's the doctor, who's the... Not all of us want to be doctors and engineers and lawyers. Most people want to just live with dignity. And so I think for me, the guilt of feeling like, again, this is where the obligation kind of comes in. I have a role to play in this. And the Dream activists, what they've done and what we're all doing kind of together is throwing all of this back to America and saying, look at us, kind of daring the entire country and the entire system to say, okay, now what do you do now? We're here and we're not who you think we are, right?
After you came out, you know, and the repercussions and the consequences, is there a side of you that just says, you know what, that pre-coming out life is gone and will never come back?
Yeah.
Do you want that life back? Is there reminiscence? Is there, or is it, you know what? Pages turned.
This is my life. What I tell a lot of these undocumented kids, this is not your identity. This is your struggle. You know, this is what you fight for. Being an undocumented person is not everything that I am. In the same way that being gay is not everything that I am. And who I am, the fullness of me, is not something that this can take away from me. I mean, look, around this time, after the Zuckerberg profile ran, I was going to do an article for Vanity Fair. I was selling a book on internet culture. I was actually working on some pilot, you know, I was doing some pilot stuff. I had a whole career, but I couldn't keep going with my life and my career without fully embracing what this is. I'm looking at this as the biggest story that I've ever worked on. It just happens to personally involve me. So the journalism in it really excites me and challenges me, and it keeps me going.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a former reporter for The Washington Post and the founder of DefineAmerican.com. While journalist Jose Antonio Vargas came out undocumented through his writing, Carlo Alban is an actor. And so the medium for his story of coming out was the stage.
Hi, I'd like to tell you a story about a Spanish fairy tale. You ready? One Once upon a time, in a land not far away.
Carlo was always a performer at heart, and as a young teen, he got a big break when he joined the regular cast of Sesame Street. Even though it seemed like he was living an American dream, he struggled with childhood success, immigration roadblocks, to later struggles with drugs and depression. Carlo Alban is now 32, and he has a one-man show entitled Intríngulis, which translates into a snag or a difficulty. The play is Carlo's own coming-out story, in which he tackles the struggles of being undocumented. Here, Carlo performs an excerpt of Intríngulis live before an intimate audience in New York City.
I fell into acting at the age of 11 when we accompanied my cousin Vivi to an audition for the musical Oliver in Union City, New Jersey. We tried out on a whim. My brother Angelo ended up playing one of Fagin's boys, and I ended up playing Oliver. My first words on the stage appropriately being, "Please, sir, I want some more." I moved on to other projects, eventually auditioning for and landing a role on Sesame Street. Nobody on the show had any idea about our legal status, and I had to use counterfeit documents to fill out my paperwork. It seems illogical that my parents would allow me to put myself out there in that way, but if you think about it, what better place to hide than in the spotlight where no one would suspect you? One night, before Thanksgiving, I hit my father. I threw a fit because he had failed to change the date on my fake green card. See, when we had bought them years before, whoever made mine put the wrong birth date on it. And this isn't something that you can return, you know, it's not like there's a money-back guarantee on counterfeit documents. I needed to use it as paperwork to be in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. I was going to ride on the Sesame Street float and sing the song and do the dance in Herald Square before an adoring television audience. It was all set. Except that Macy's, the employer, needed proof that I was allowed to work because I was underage. And for that, I needed my fake green card, which was the only illegal document I had that proved that I was legally allowed to work. But it had the wrong birth date, and I was convinced that somebody from Sesame Street was going to notice that date and say, "Wait a second. What's going on here? You weren't born on the 4th of July. You were born in October. We celebrated your birthday just last month in Hooper Store while you were chopping onions during the Why Is Carlo Crying segment. Somebody call immigration!" I was terrified. So I instructed my father to change the date at his office, assuming, of course, that my dad had the forging skills of James Bond. Except that my dad was not an international super spy or a movie star. He was a cheesemonger, so he didn't change the date. And I flipped out. I kicked over a chair, I flipped over a couch, and I hit my father. I punched him in the chest. So he put his hands on my shoulders to try to calm me down, and I grabbed him by the neck and accused him of trying to choke me. It was very melodramatic. It runs in the family. My mother ran out of the living room crying. I was crying. The cat was crying. Food, I think. My father may have cried. He probably cried, but it must have been in private because I never saw it. The next day, he drove me into the city at the crack of dawn, and he waited for me patiently in the car while I rode that float and waved to the people lining the streets of Manhattan. Hundreds of thousands of people. And they all waved back and smiled as if I was one of them. And then he drove me home in a deafening silence. And nobody looked at the car.
Carlo Alban is an actor and playwright. We heard excerpts from his one-man show, Intríngulis. We're going to take a short break now, but we continue our special report coming out undocumented in America. No se vayan.
Tenemos que seguir, compañero, miedo no hay. Por el camino cierto, unidos para crecer y andar. Vamos a repartir, compañero, el campo y el mar. El pan, la vida, mi brazo, mi pecho hecho para amar. Americana patria morena quiero tener. Guitarra y canto libre en tu amanecer. En la pampa mi poncho volar, estera de viento y luna, viento y luna. Oh, oh, oh. vamos a sembrar, compañero, con la verdad.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. The stories of José Antonio Vargas and Carlo Alban are like so many who grew up in the United States, undocumented, but managing to start careers despite the obstacles of not having papers. But not all are so lucky. They are the high school and college students who call themselves dreamers. They're fighting for the passage of the DREAM Act, which would grant a passage to citizenship to students and to members of the military. For more than a decade, it's been an uphill battle to get votes to pass the DREAM Act. And in recent years, these students have upped the ante by coming out publicly and often putting themselves at risk of deportation.
My name is Viridiana Martinez. I am undocumented. If you're watching this video, I've been arrested. I grew up in the small town of Stanford, North Carolina. I'm a proud North Carolinian.
My name is Georgina Perez. I'm undocumented and I am unafraid. I was brought to the U.S. when I was 3 years old. Currently, I'm 21 years old. I'm ready to stand up and fight back for my community.
My name is Mohammed and I'm undocumented. My parents immigrated from Iran, which is on the other side of the world, when I was just 3 years old. You know, going to high school, I always knew I was undocumented, but I never really understood what it meant until it was that time when everybody was applying for colleges.
My name is Lisbeth Mateo. I'm originally from Oaxaca, Mexico, but I've lived in L.A. for a long time now, and I graduated from Cal State Northridge in 2008.
Lisbeth Mateo was born in Mexico and came to Los Angeles with her family when she was 14 years old. She knew of her undocumented status, but she didn't fully understand what that meant for her future.
It was shocking. It was heartbreaking because I've always wanted to go to college and become a lawyer.
Lisbeth Mateo did get into college. And as a student at Cal State Northridge, Mateo and her friends started a campus organization in support of the DREAM Act. In 2007, when immigration reform reached the Senate floor, Mateo decided to do something drastic. She stood in front of the library, dressed in her cap and gown, declaring for the first time to all that she was undocumented.
The coming out actions in itself, it's pushing the envelope, because for years we were told, you know, you have to be careful with how you approach people or when you say you're undocumented, like you only do it in safe spaces, never in public. And over the last couple of years, we've seen people doing it everywhere. I mean, David went to Campus Progress, did a speech in front of thousands of people. He came out in front of City Hall.
David Cho arrived legally with his family from South Korea when he was 9 years old. But years later, while filling out his application to UCLA, he was stunned to find out that, in fact, he didn't have legal status.
On the UC application, there's a space that asks for your social security number, and I asked my parents what my social security number was. And obviously, that was when my dad showed me a letter saying that our visa wasn't valid anymore.
A sponsor had mismanaged their immigration paperwork, and all of their efforts to renew their visas fell short. Despite these obstacles, he eventually managed to get into UCLA, studying economics, where he also became a drum major with the marching band. Unlike Mateo, Cho didn't see himself as an activist. But during his sophomore year, Cho made a speech at an event in front of the Los Angeles City Hall, where he announced to thousands of people that he, too, was undocumented.
There was a huge rally, and it was definitely a life-changing experience. The night before, I was so scared that I might get deported or someone might shoot me or something, so I actually wrote a will to my family and my friends because, you know, I just didn't know what was going to happen.
At first, his parents feared the repercussions of his decision, especially with all that he had accomplished as a student.
They were saying, you know, why don't you just keep your head under the table, you know, let other people do the work for you, why do you have to step up? But I realized that, you know, this is affecting me, but it's also affecting so many other students across this country, and I needed to step up. I, you know, shouldn't just, you know, be silent and do nothing about it.
When Cho was invited to make a speech at the Campus Progress National Conference in Washington, D.C. in 2010, his lack of a driver's license didn't get in the way. His parents still had theirs, and so they drove him from California to D.C. so he could deliver his speech.
These are my goals, my dreams, and my American dream that I want to achieve, but I cannot fulfill them because of my status. Today, however, I stand before you all freed from doubt and fear and filled with courage and confidence, for I believe in the power of our generation, and I know that we will never lose hope in this time of trials and tribulations.
Like David Cho, Lisbeth Mateo also became a national figure in the Dreamer movement. 2 years ago, she, along with several other Dreamers, chained themselves together in a sit-in at Senator McCain's office. She was arrested and later released, but the act of civil disobedience meant that she found herself under deportation proceedings.
Protesters stirring things up in downtown Tucson at this hour. This is a live picture just outside Senator John McCain's office. Inside, five protesters, all reportedly illegal immigrants, are refusing to leave, demanding that the senator support the DREAM Act.
We are at risk of deportation every single day just by walking on the street. You don't know what could happen. You don't know if you can be stopped by a cop and, you know, who will question you about your legal status. Maybe not in L.A., but there's other states that do that, right? We wanted to willingly risk that to show the kind of actions that we're willing to take because our lives are just unbearable. And we've had people who have committed suicide. And we cannot take that any longer. We cannot just sit there and not do something, even if that means, you know, you're risking yourself and you're risking deportation.
David Cho recently married an American citizen and is now eligible to fix his status. He's working on his master's in public policy at UCLA, but he still advocates for the DREAM Act.
One of my main mantras through this movement was change takes courage, because with that quote, I decided to come out as an undocumented student. But after the Senate failed to pass the DREAM Act, I realized that change also takes time too.
And Lisbeth Mateo continues to advocate for the passage of the DREAM Act.
When injustice becomes law, then rebellion becomes duty. I think it's pretty radical when a student stands up in front of thousands of people and says, my name is, and I'm undocumented. That takes a lot of courage. If I had to do it again, I would do it, maybe even sooner. Yeah, so I have no regrets.
Like Lisbeth, in the end, I would not regret it. It's something that I had to do, and if I did it, then, you know, something that I would stick by it.
DREAM activists Lisbeth Mateo and David Cho speaking to us last summer on the campus lawn at UCLA. And that's it for this week's Latino USA. Our program is produced by Mincho Jacob with Andres Caballero, with help from Tina Rubio and Maria Martin. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Funding for Latino USA is provided in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, supporting families leading change.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Pew Charitable Trust, working with states to improve the accuracy and lessen the cost of voter registration at pewtrust.org, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org, and the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.